From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. When mighty UC Davis went up against football archrival Cal Poly last weekend, at stake was a glittering, giant golden horseshoe. Ahead on Only a Game, we'll reveal the winner. Also, previews of this weekend's big gridiron matchups and the MLS Cup final, and a conversation with Declan Hill, author of The Fix, Soccer and Organized Crime. Also ahead, a Tennessee community college hopes to achieve basketball glory, or at least get a few laughs, with the help of a 73-year-old sophomore.
He's a little bit awkward, a little bit stiff. He's a pretty good shooter. That looks really good. And I thought, well, you know, if he was some perfect Jack LaLanne, it probably wouldn't be really as interesting.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The man who will be president has made his preference clear, and those who hate the BCS have reason now to cheer. For who would foil the president, and who would call his bluff? Those playoff-hating senators? I think there aren't enough. For which reason, it would seem that we can expect college football to ditch the bowl championship series and adopt a playoff format, unless that doesn't turn out to be quite as pressing to the Obama administration as, universal health care, getting out of Iraq, resuscitating the economy, changes of that nature. Joining me now to discuss this and various other matters pertaining to college football is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, welcome back to the program.
You act like those other things are important.
So what do you think? Will President-elect Obama's preference for a college football playoff system be enough to bring about that change, despite the announcement this week of the deal that will have the BCS bowl games broadcast on ESPN through 2014?
Well, the deal for 2014 had already been set, so you know, we would need a second term of the Obama administration. I'm not ready to get into endorsing or not endorsing. I do believe, though, had Barack Obama come out with his full support of a college football playoff prior to Election Day, and he only kind of hinted at it, the states he lost were all in the SEC and the Big 12. I mean, this guy could have gone 49-1. I mean, if you stand down there at Auburn, Alabama, at Toomer's Corner, and discuss feeling the pain of the 2005 Tigers when they went 13-0 and yet could not play for the national championship. Alabama's in play. I'm sorry. But Idaho, those people at Boise State hate the BCS. So I think he missed the boat on this one, though. He really could have run it up on McCain.
Getting to some of the teams that we should talk about, Texas Tech is unbeaten. In their past two games, they've knocked off two top 10 teams, Texas and Oklahoma State. Do they have enough left in the tank to travel to Oklahoma tonight and beat the number 5 ranked Sooners?
Well, I think they do, because Texas Tech has a brilliant offense and Oklahoma has a very sketchy defense. However, it is nighttime in Norman. Bob Stoops has been there 9 seasons. He's lost twice at home that whole time. So it's going to be a big-time game. So as long as they don't wilt under the pressure, I do think they have enough to beat Oklahoma tonight. And they're 10-0, and they're in the driver's seat. They keep winning. They're going to play for the title.
Number 8 Penn State hosts number 15 Michigan State today in the Big Ten matchup with Rose Bowl implications. The Spartans have never beaten the Nittany Lions at Happy Valley. Will today be the day?
I don't think so. I think Michigan State's had a great season, but there's steps to. They haven't beaten a very good team yet. They beat all the teams that weren't very good on their schedule, but they've lost the two games that were pretty good. I think Penn State's good. I think Penn State will finish that out and get to 11-1 and reach the Rose Bowl for what that's worth.
This is the final year of Joe Paterno's contract at Penn State, and both he and the university have put off any talk of his coaching future until after the season. So what do you think? Will Joe Pa be back for a record 44th year?
Predicting anything with an 82-year-old would be impossible. He would prefer to come back. He's hardly coaching now, though. The thing is, most of the work is done by his assistants due to some injuries and ailments. Doesn't even work the sidelines. He sits up in the press box and watches the game. I think this would be a really good time for Joe Paterno to maybe retire, go out on top, feeling good about things and where the program is.
The state of Utah has two teams in the top 25, and they're facing off today in Salt Lake City. What's at stake for number 7 Utah and number 14 Brigham Young?
Well, besides the bragging rights in the state of Utah, which is a little more fervent than you would think, Utah's got a lot at stake because they're undefeated, and they would pretty much secure a chance to play in one of the big BCS bowls against a big-name team. There is at least some outside possibility, although very, very small, that they could reach the championship game. But they have a shot at an undefeated season. This would be their second one in 4 years. BYU is a one-loss team. They have an excellent squad. They could possibly sneak into a BCS game also. So a lot on the line in that game. It isn't getting as much attention, basically, because it's out in the Mountain West. But major implications and a great rivalry game between those two schools.
Ohio State and Michigan have one of the game's great rivalries, of course, but the Wolverines are struggling this year. Can Michigan play the spoiler to the 10th-ranked Buckeyes today?
No, Michigan's terrible this year. They have won three games. They used to complain about their old coach. He used to lose four games. Now they can't even win four games. Ohio State should be able to win this. It's been a disastrous first season for Rich Rodriguez at Michigan. The fans are on him. He told the ones most critical of him to get a life this week, which is really such a good idea. If they got a life, right, this would be the Ivy League.
These stadiums would be half empty,
right,
and the libraries would be bigger.
Yes, the symphonies. No, we don't want you to get a life. Drink beer, watch the game, and think it's really important
and
that we win.
And I will contribute to the booster fund.
You make me rich. It's really a simple concept. I have no idea. I mean, I swear the other coaches around the country are calling Rich Rodriguez this week saying, quiet. Don't let them in on the...
Don't rock the boat.
We do not want Michigan fans to get a life. 110,000 of them, this is their life. Bad year for Michigan. They'll start up anew next year, and Rich Rodriguez will be under a tremendous amount of pressure to deliver a more Wolverine-like season of 9, 10, 11 wins.
Dan, it feels to me as if we've talked about a great many college football games. Have we missed any that we should have talked about?
One of the great rivalries is always Washington versus Washington State, and it's called the Apple Cup. But this year it's called the Rotten Apple Cup because the two teams have combined for a 1-20 record.
I love it.
All your listeners in the state of Washington that are driving to the game today or planning on seeing the game, call Rich Rodriguez. He may have some advice for you.
Dan Wetzel covers college football for Yahoo Sports. Dan, thanks very much for joining me.
Appreciate it.
Symbolic trophies of long-running college football rivalry games, past and present, include gems like the Kit Carson rifle, the peace pipe, the beehive boot, the keg of nails, the Seminole war canoe, the bronze turkey, and the highly coveted Omicron Delta Kappa James E. Foy V sportsmanship trophy. And there's a relatively new gleaming gridiron guerdon to add to that list, which Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder viewed last weekend in San Luis Obispo, California.
If you've ever wondered how an otherwise routine annual college football game magically transforms into one of those big rivalry games, consider the case of UC Davis and Cal Poly. The two California teams played each other for years. Then, about 5 years ago, UC Davis's director of marketing called Cal Poly's associate athletic director for advancement, Chris Baker, and just asked if he wanted to give their annual game a fancy title.
I said, yeah, you know, we've been actually thinking about it, and you know, it helps with the rivalry, I think. It helps with the student body and their spirit getting behind the game, so everyone knows what the Golden Horseshoe Classic is now.
The game is actually called the Battle for the Golden Horseshoe. Hey, it's still kind of new. And its creation was a no-brainer to Cal Poly, Baker says. After all, UC Davis is their arch rival. But for the game to become a real rivalry, he tells me, it needed some sort of prize.
You know, all the big rivalries in big college football, they pass those trophies along, so they wanted to come up with one for us.
Both schools asked their spirit groups to produce a trophy, which they did. Given that the teams boast the same mascot, Mustang, it was probably inevitable that they'd both come up with the same design.
And then whoever won the inaugural Horseshoe Classic game, that was the trophy that would go back and forth between the two schools.
UC Davis won the first Battle for the Golden Horseshoe in 2004, so the trophy, you guessed it, a rather large, unwieldy golden horseshoe, is the result of their handiwork. Cal Poly won in 2006 and 2007, so they went into last weekend's game possessing the gilded laurel. Cal Poly student Chris Ruiz volunteered to carry the trophy into Alex G. Spanos Stadium. but he probably didn't anticipate how heavy it'd get on the long walk down South Perimeter Road.
How much does it weigh?
Not too sure about that one.
It looks pretty heavy to me.
Oh yeah, it gets pretty tiring to carry on the way down.
The teams have only battled for the Golden Horseshoe four times, but according to Cal Poly's former Dean of Students, Everett M. Chandler, the two schools have been rivals for decades. Today, Chandler admits both schools are still better known for their agriculture departments than for their football rivalry.
But it's growing, I would say. That's a few years, Davis wasn't really a very strong team, and a few years we weren't. And so that it didn't grow until recently, and I think it may grow, but it's not in the same category as a Cal-Stanford, I would say.
The Cal-Stanford game is big in this part of California, which makes sense. They're both large schools with major national football programs. But in the former Division I AA, where Cal Poly and Davis play, national recognition is pretty much non-existent. That is, until today, when Cal Poly travels to Wisconsin to play in an end-of-the-season David versus Goliath matchup.
They're enthralled with the size of the stadium and just thinking about being in a venue that is that big.
That's Arlene Chandler, Everett's wife. She tells me the Wisconsin game is a great opportunity for Cal Poly. For one, the team gets to play in a stadium that's eight times the size of their own. For another,
I think it is going to give Cal Poly a whole new kind of fame. Hey, maybe some people will say, Cal Poly who?
It could also give Cal Poly a few things they don't want, according to the school's media relations director, Brian Thurmond.
Going into the end of the year, playing a team that is more physical, more athletic, more scholarships, you have to be concerned about injuries.
And after Wisconsin beat Minnesota last weekend, they're now in contention for a bowl game and might not think twice about crushing Cal Poly, says Thurmond. But Cal Poly wasn't looking beyond Davis in last weekend's fifth annual battle for the Golden Horseshoe. A win would allow them to retain the two-foot-high bejeweled trophy and capture the 2008 Great West Conference Championship.
Stop it!
When Davis fumbled the ball on the opening kickoff, it looked like it was going to be Cal Poly's day. But Davis hung tough. At halftime, the game was tied at 21. But after a motivational talk by senior leadership, Cal Poly pulled away.
15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9.
Final score, 51-28 in favor of Cal Poly. Just minutes after their victory, the team hoisted the Golden Horseshoe into the air. In the midst of the celebration, I asked Cal Poly's defensive back, Blaze Silberman, what's more important, winning the Golden Horseshoe or the Great West title? But he only had one thing on his mind.
Wisconsin's deck. Wisconsin's on the list right now. Wisconsin's on the list.
And you can be sure, Cal Poly's on theirs. For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in San Luis Obispo, California.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. It's a trick that should not be tolerated anymore by the referees, said Paolo Casarin, who used to be the coordinator of referees in Italy's Pro Soccer League. Mr. Casarin was referring to the maneuver employed Sunday by several members of Catania, a Sicilian team. In setting up for a penalty kick, the players formed a wall in front of the opposing team's goal and dropped their shorts to their knees, thus further obscuring the view of Torino goalkeeper Matteo Cerini. The trick was not spontaneous, according to Catania's chief executive, Pietro Lomonaco. This is a strategy that coach Walter Zenga tries continually in training, he said. And one presumes he was smiling when he said it, since the play resulted in the winning goal. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, shenanigans on the soccer pitch. But first, tomorrow afternoon at the Home Depot Center in Carson, California, the New York Red Bulls and the Columbus Crew will play for Major League Soccer's championship. Neither team has previously made it to the championship game, but beyond that, they seem to have little in common. Joining me now to discuss the matchup is Michael Lewis of the New York Daily News, who has been covering the Red Bulls this season. Michael, welcome to Only a Game.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Red Bulls, their name notwithstanding, did not exactly bull their way into the playoffs, did they? In fact, it's fair to say they backed in. Did you expect them to get as far as they've gotten?
Well, early on in the season, I think that everyone expected them to make the playoffs, but they did not play very well during the final stretch of the season. And yes, they were very fortunate to get in. They got in on the last game of the season when, ironically, the Columbus Crew defeated DC United 1-0. Now Columbus gets a chance to beat the team they brought into the playoffs. There's a lot of irony there.
Yeah. Columbus, on the other hand, had the best regular season record in the league, thereby winning the Supporters' Shield. By the time they played New York late in the season, the Crew had already clinched that distinction, and Columbus coach Siggy Schmidt played his reserves. But at this point, does it matter which team had the more impressive regular season?
At this moment, no. There's no doubt that Columbus is the best team in the league, had the best season, but when you get to the playoffs in any sport, it comes down to who's the hottest team in a lot of cases. And the Red Bulls have been on a roll. Saying that, you could flip a coin and make an argument for each side on who's going to win tomorrow. So,
well, I want to get down to the particulars of this role that the Red Bulls have been on. Successful soccer teams often, if not always, have luck on their side, of course. But after watching the opposing team hit the post 6 times in 2 consecutive playoff games against Houston and then Salt Lake, I wonder if the Red Bulls feel as if they're destiny's darlings.
After the last game in Salt Lake City, I went up to one of the equipment managers after the match, and I said, you know, now you could take the invisible barrier away from the goal, because it just seems like no matter what the opposing team puts toward the net, they have been quite fortunate. But I subscribe to a theory that the late, great Branch Rickey once said, luck is the residue of design. There is a certain amount of hard work and talent involved, too. But I'll tell you this, sometimes I'd rather be lucky than good.
I've heard that a number of times, yes. Toward the end of the regular season, the Red Bulls lost their regular goalkeeper, John Conway, to suspension. He tested positive for a banned substance. Did you or anybody else watching the team think that Danny Sapuro, the substitute keeper who makes all of $12,900 in salary this season, would be as good as he has been?
No. He's a second-year player, but essentially a rookie in the league. He had not played a minute. And you just don't know until you throw a player or someone into water to see if they could swim. Obviously, not only he could swim, but he could do a couple of strokes as well, too. Back, breast. But he has been the story of the playoffs. It's an amazing run on his part. I wish I could have been that wise early on to say, oh, he's going to stand on his head and score a goal in his first game. Which is
remarkable.
Part of
the only MLS goalkeeper to have done so.
I mean, it's astonishing when you think of it. Here's someone who's playing in his first game, and all he wants to do is play well, and he did play well. And with the Red Bulls leading 2-1 in the 83rd minute, he took a free kick some 80, 85 yards away, bounced once over the Columbus goalkeeper's head into the net. I mean, I've never seen this before. I've been covering soccer for way, way many years, and I live for moments like this, but I had to see it a second and third time to really grasp what had happened.
Perhaps the most dangerous Columbus player, and he was just named the league's most valuable player, is Guillermo Barros Schelotto, late of Argentina's Boca Juniors. Is it fair to say that a guy like that, a really serious veteran, makes this veterans versus the youngsters?
In some respects, Columbus do have a number of youngsters as well, too. But Schelotto is someone who's going to set up goals, score goals, but as a leader, talking to players, setting example. It's definitely an interesting matchup in that you've got, you know, again, the best team in the league against the team that's fortunate to make the playoffs. And it makes it a lot more fun. And I guess there are just so many layers to this MLS Cup final. I'm just hoping, crossing my fingers, it's going to be a fun game to watch. That's all I ask for.
Most of what I've read this week suggests that your analysis is shared by everybody else. You've got the best team in the league against a team that may not have even deserved to have gotten this far. Columbus is the overwhelming favorite. What has New York coach Juan Carlos Osorio been telling the Red Bulls to convince them that they can win this thing?
The power of positive thinking. I really think he's just working on players, their confidence. You've got some young players who are playing out of their skin, diving after the extra ball, making that extra run, and knowing that they can do it. And I think if you know you can do it, you're halfway there. You've got to have the talent, but you also have to have that desire. And Juan Carlos Osorio is known as an X's and O's coach, but I think we're also learning he's very good with psychology of players. And as we all know, that's just as important or even more important depending on the team and the player in this day and age.
Well, you've been covering the Red Bulls, as I said, all season, so I may not be asking for the most unbiased prediction, but go ahead, give me your prediction about how you think this thing's going to turn out tomorrow.
Well, okay, I'm probably going to get a lot of emails from Columbus Crew fans on this since I'm telegraphing the final. I think the Red Bulls are going to find a way to win 2-1. I just get the sense it's a magical season for them, and it's going to continue. And saying that, Columbus is a superb team. I think they have an excellent coach in Siggy Schmidt. And if they win, I'm not going to jump out of the press box by any means. But it's just one of those, I guess, Destiny's Darlings, as you brought up earlier. And I just think they're going to find a way to win. They have so far.
Michael Lewis writes about the New York Red Bulls and Major League Soccer for the New York Daily News. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, my pleasure.
In his new book, The Fix, Declan Hill maintains that professional soccer is in trouble. His contention is that match fixing has occurred and is occurring at the highest levels of the game, a circumstance that could destroy the public's confidence in soccer's integrity, causing people to turn away from it. Declan Hill joins me now from the CBC in Ottawa. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. Thank you very much for having me on the program.
Tell me a little bit about what specific incidents led you to feel that an investigation into the integrity of professional soccer was necessary.
Gosh, it's so widespread. It's truly extraordinary. I mean, and I have to say, right from the beginning, Bill, much of this I didn't expect to find when I went out and began my investigation. I mean, I had no idea, for example, of the prevalence during the 1990s of sex bribes for Champions League referees. Champions League is the kind of pan-European club tournament, and a number of the top prominent clubs would, on a regular basis, offer referees before the games highly paid prostitutes. I actually spoke with the guy that used to arrange these things for the referees, and I almost fell out of my chair when I was interviewing this guy about how normal it was in the game.
But you've begun by speaking about something that happened in the 90s and that resulted in trials. Is this sort of thing still going on? Is that your contention?
There's a number of people that maintain that particular culture of sex bribes continue. There have been a number of books written about it. Look, for a North American sports fan, what I'm about to say seems extraordinary. But most of soccer associations, they call them football over there, do not have what is standard practice in North America, which is a security department. You know, you go to the National Hockey League or the National Basketball Association or any of those big professional sports leagues here in North America, and they have a department staffed with former big city cops, FBI agents. Soccer associations, even the World Soccer Association, an organization called FIFA, UEFA, don't have those bodies. And the whole point of the debate around the book now, and what I'm arguing and many of my people who've read the book say as well, is we need these security departments and we need them ASAP.
Your investigation led you to meet with men you identify as Asian criminals in Bangkok. You maintain that, quote, European sport leagues were facing a tsunami of match fixing by these criminals. What particulars led you to that conclusion?
The beginning part of the book talks about the surreal nature of Asian sports leagues. they have been so widely corrupted by the gambling market. It's a gambling market which is far bigger than Las Vegas. It's mostly illegal. In the book, I compare them to locusts. They've descended on the farmer's field of the soccer league in China and Thailand, Indonesia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Malaysia, Singapore, and they've effectively destroyed it. So what the sports fans have now done is they've really switched their attention to the European soccer. They've really kind of given up on the local leagues. But more importantly, so have the gamblers. So the gamblers are less and less betting on the Asian sports leagues, and now they're starting to bet on the European sports leagues. This is globalization. So what are the fixers doing? They're coming to Europe. I spoke with a law enforcement source in Belgium who told me that there was one guy, Yeze Hun, who was a match fixer from Shanghai, who approached 14 of the top 18 teams in Belgium, worked effectively for a year, fixed dozens of games in that league, and nobody talked about it. Nobody did anything about it.
In one of the particular games upon which you focus, Brazil beat Ghana during the second round of the World Cup in Germany 2 years ago. Upon hearing that gamblers had influenced that particular game, I would think most people would assume that somehow Brazil had lost or been tied. How did you conclude that a game ending precisely as people might expect it to end was fixed?
This is a really, really, really good point. And I started with that expectation when I began my research 5 years ago, that a fix would be the big team losing. But remember, when you're talking about long-term match corruption and corruption in sport, what you're trying to do is do two things. One is you're obviously fixing potentially referees and players. The other side is that you're trying to fix the gambling market, which is effectively like a stock market. So one of the ways that they do that is they'll bet and they'll fix the way everyone thinks it will fix. So if I am to fix Bill's team who's going to play a friendly game against the New York Rangers, for example, everyone expects Bill's team to lose. So when Bill's team does lose above a certain point spread, no one is surprised. You're able to get away with a fix much more easily.
Did you find any evidence of match fixing by these Asian gamblers or by anybody else when the wealthier European or English teams were playing each other?
No, I didn't. I interviewed more than 220 people. Players, referees, soccer officials, policemen, prosecutors, but also the fixers themselves. And one particular guy we met in Bangkok, it was late one night, and we spent 2.5 hours talking about this. And while he was talking to me, the phone would be ringing, and he said that he was fixing the Southeast Asian games at the time. 2 weeks later, it was revealed that those games were fixed. The soccer tournament was fixed. And I said, what's the biggest match you've ever fixed? And he said, well, which is bigger, the Olympics or the World Cup? And I just laughed, I mean, as politely as one does when facing an organized crime guy. And he said, well, I'll show you. And so he took me into meetings, and he took me into one particular meeting, which I describe in the book, where at a table just beside me was a representative, he claimed, from Ghana. He said he was an under-17 national coach.
Yeah, curiously enough, this is a meeting that takes place in a Kentucky Fried Chicken in Cambodia, which lends a certain surreal kind of quality to the whole thing.
Bill, the whole thing was surreal. Then I go to Ghana, and I discover the same gentleman that I saw in the Kentucky Fried Chicken had just been revealed trying to fix the Ghana-Iran game. I then went to the captain of the team and most of the guys on that team, and the captain of the team said, yes, I know those guys. I've taken money from them at the Olympic tournament just for winning a game. I took $20,000. And yes, they did approach me during the World Cup, and I turned them away. I refused. Again, in the book, not only the fixers are saying this, but the referees, the players, the very soccer officials are saying, every single tournament we go to, under 17, under 20, Women's World Cup, there was a clear attempt to fix a game at the last Women's World Cup in China.
I'm talking with Declan Hill, author of The Fix, and you're listening to Only a Game. Based on what you heard about some of the African teams competing internationally, it would seem that men who were worried about whether their teams might be unable or unwilling to pay them would be especially susceptible to temptation by gamblers. Is that what you discovered?
Absolutely. People are focusing now on Africa. Some of the fixers mentioned talking about approaching guys from former Soviet team. I actually want to talk about one of the great shameful moments for my country, Canada. when Canadian athletes, Canadian soccer players, took money from these guys in Singapore in 1987. We had four or five guys on our national team that took these guys' money. So it's not just a question of Africans or just a question of former Soviet guys. When you have that imbalance of guys that are relatively good but not great and relatively badly paid, that's when the fixers move in.
How have team and league and FIFA officials responded to your book, if they've had time to do so?
Some people have responded extremely well. In fact, what I find is that the players really respond well. They know some of the stuff that goes on. There are some officials, for example, the Danish Football Association immediately put in an excellent initiative, a whistleblower hotline for some of their players. Unfortunately, FIFA, the president of FIFA is a guy named Sepp Blatter, who I end the book with in an interview with, who essentially said, I don't believe what you're saying is true, but if it is true, I have failed. My entire 35 years in football, soccer, has been a failure. So unfortunately, his response once the book came out was negative. Rather than working with me, rather than saying, okay, these are a serious menace to the sport, how are we going to deal with it, how are we going to approach it, rather he spent much of his time trying to rubbish it.
In 2010, South Africa will host the Men's World Cup. All over the world, teams are playing to qualify for that event even as we speak. Have you seen any evidence of fixing in the run-up to that event in South Africa?
No, I haven't. I've cut off my communication with those fixers for obvious reasons. You know, I think your listeners and you appreciate that what the research that I did was in some ways dangerous. So I haven't really spoken to those sources since the book has come out.
Declan Hill is the author of The Fix, Soccer and Organized Crime, published by McClellan and Stewart. He joined me from the CBC in Ottawa. Declan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
4 years have gone by, but it never once mind. It's a time to wait for a sign. Football in our lives takes place in our hearts. Champions all around, it's so magical to see. This is the way we love the world to play. Ale, ale. Do you mind if I play?
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hit it, boys.
Rap music by Jay-Z helps LeBron James of the Cleveland Cavaliers prepare for games, but it turns out James's taste in music is eclectic. Told recently that Carmelo Anthony of the Denver Nuggets acknowledged last season that he had some Barry Manilow on his iPod, James said that he probably did too. Challenged by a reporter to prove same, James searched his playlist and initially admitted defeat. Nope, no Brian Manilow, he said. As those gathered around James laughed, he was advised to try Barry Manilow. LeBron came up with Copacabana, Mandy, and I Am Your Child. Asked if he ever listened to sports talk radio on his way home after a game, James replied, never, ever.
I write the songs that make the young girls cry. I write the songs, I write the songs.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. The only college basketball player in the land who could have watched Wilt Chamberlain take foul shots underhanded without benefit of film or video. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Baseball's most valuable players were named this week. Albert Pujols in the National League, no particular surprise there. And Dustin Pedroia in the American League. What do you think?
Dustin Pedroia is a surprise if this is still April. He's not a surprise at the end of the year. He was every bit the most valuable player on the Red Sox. It's too bad for Kevin Youkilis, his teammate, who also had a terrific year. This is a victory for short, feisty people everywhere. And as one myself, I take it as a personal triumph.
In this case, short, feisty middle infielders.
Right.
Kind of fun. Yankees pitcher Mike Mussina announced his retirement on Thursday. No surprise there. He only won 20 games last season. But how the heck will the Yankees find another top starter?
Well, you know what? Luckily, they really want CC Sabathia, but they've given him a deadline.
Yes, so I understand.
A deadline. It's not going to be there forever, says
Hal Stein. This $138 million you're talking about.
Yes, this $138 million offer over 6 years won't be there forever. So you better pick it real fast because we're the Yankees and we can blacklist. I mean, this is the Yankees being the Yankees.
Yeah.
They will wait until George Steinbrenner's eventual eternal destination freezes over before they'll get rid of this offer.
After the 2008 World Series controversial, not to mention cold and rainy, Game 5, Bud Selig has announced that Major League Baseball will not allow postseason games to be shortened by the weather. So, now he's commissioner of weather.
Either he's claiming he can stop the weather, in which case he's the most talented used car salesman in the history of Milwaukee, or possibly the entire state of Wisconsin, or, sooner or later, we're in for a 9-hour, 300-pitch Game 7 of the World Series in the upper latitude somewhere.
Turning to baseball in Japan, 16-year-old Ari Yoshida, female pitcher, signed by the Kobe 9 Cruise. Legitimate prospect or publicity stunt?
Well, first of all, the Kobe 9 Cruise sounds like a rap group. Do we know what this team is all about?
Either that or one of those big boats that goes out and goes nowhere and comes back.
Eventually, this was going to happen at one level of pro baseball or another. Pitcher is one of the few positions in all of sports, goalie and hockey being another one, where you could see a woman competing in a men's league on a professional level. And the knuckleball, you know, the knuckleball screws up the mind. Anybody who can throw the knuckleball can get a job.
Charlie Pete Newell died on Monday at the age of 93. Would it be an exaggeration to say that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Bill Walton, and Shaquille O'Neal all owe something to Mr. Newell?
This was first of all, he was one of the nicest men I ever met. Second of all, he knew more about basketball than anybody. And how you know that is that Bobby Knight even admits that he knows more about basketball than Bobby Knight does. But he devoted himself to teaching the lost art of playing the low post game. And the three people you mentioned are probably the last three outside of Hakeem Olajuwon, who actually were not 7 foot tall guys who wanted to be 6 foot 5 inch jump shooting forwards. He will be missed. And if you ever see the video of the 150 pound lighter Shaquille O'Neal at his camp, it's really terrific.
There was a big upset in men's college hoops on Thursday. Unranked Michigan stunned number 4 UCLA 55-52. I'm wondering if this is going to be a season of topsy-turvy hardcourt results.
Well, UCLA was overrated to start with, and Southern Cal was also overrated, lost this week too. John Beilein, who used to coach at West Virginia, is a terrific coach. He's taking a Michigan program that was dead in the water, and the most impressive thing about this game is they held UCLA to 52 points.
My understanding is that the women's college basketball season will continue despite the fact that Tennessee lost one of their first two games and is not ranked in the top 10 this week. Am I right about that?
Wait a minute. I'm looking down the list. I'm not seeing them. This must be a misprint. Oh, there they are in 13th place. That'll last about 3 weeks, I think. But, yeah, it's unusual to see, isn't it?
Tennessee's fans may be hungry and not just for wins. At Vols basketball games, I guess there's no longer any such thing as a free dinner.
Yeah, I used to get vouchered for a hot dog and a Coke, which is kind of like tiny high school charming, but they claim that this will save them $80,000. I refuse to believe that any hot dog served at any sporting arena is worth something that would total up to $80,000, but that's not for small minds to ponder.
Dallas Cowboys quarterback Tony Romo helped an elderly couple fix a flat tire on a Dallas area highway earlier this season, and now he's added yet another gold star to his Good Samaritan cape. What's he done this time?
Well, before we talk about that, he also showed up at a high school pep rally with Will Smith. He took a homeless man to the movies. Doc was passing out flyers for a consignment store. But apparently, when he knew who was inviting him, he ran across the street and got the day off and went in.
What I love about this is Romo sat beside him and watched the movie. I mean, this wasn't just, here's a couple of bucks, go see a movie.
Yeah, Doc said, he told Romo that he hadn't showered in a few days, and Romo said, don't worry, I'm used to locker rooms. So people are going to think I made that up, but it's the absolute truth.
Texas announced this week that Will Muschamp will be the next head football coach there, and he is being paid accordingly, even though nobody, least of all Mr. Muschamp, is certain when he'll take on the job. Why is that?
Yeah, he's gotten what we like to call the Prince Charles Fellowship in college football.
Mm-hmm.
Mack Brown is 57, and he has no intention of leaving. He's got 8 years left on his deal. There's no reason to believe he won't coach all eight of them. Muschamp, at that point, of course, will be 45. He'll still be really young. But you're going to see more and more of this, I think, as you have the situation now at Florida State and at Penn State, where nobody's really sure who the heir apparent is. And that, and as Michigan is proving this year, it doesn't take long for a program to slide back to the pack. So this is a move for stability, I think, at Texas. And also a move to keep Mr. Muschamp there.
It's not a bad deal to be getting $900,000 a year and not even be responsible if the team loses.
Well, considering he's just got to Texas this year, they must like him a great deal.
In discussing whether or not he will ride in the 2009 Tour de France, Lance Armstrong said this week, "I don't want to enter an unsafe situation." What's his concern?
He's afraid someone's going to attack him. Apparently things have gotten a little rowdy along the tour route, and he figures himself to be a target. You know, he's talking about directors of French teams that have encouraged people to take to the streets and sort of jostle the riders and stuff. I don't recall any of this going on, but he seems to think he's a fairly unique target in this regard.
Speaking of unsafe situations, Evander Holyfield is 46 years old. He hasn't been in the ring for over a year. He's lost a bunch of fights to non-entities since he turned 40. And next month, he's going to fight a guy who's 7 feet tall and weighs 350 pounds. This can't possibly be a good idea.
Well, he had to go to Germany to get the medical tests to prove he was prepared to fight this guy Nikolai Valuev, I guess is the pronunciation. I don't know anything about Nikolai, but I know a lot about Evander Holyfield. He should have quit 15 years ago. This is an embarrassment. Nobody should put this on TV. Nobody should go. And the country of Germany should have its medical license suspended for finding doctors who are willing to certify this.
And finally, Charlie, the dreaded Canadian Broadcast Standards Council has spoken, and it has said that Daryl Cronzy, the host of a Canadian TV fishing show, was wrong to have attempted to influence an October 2007 election in Ontario. Was a reprimand 13 months after the election pretty much the suitable punishment?
Well, the Canadians, they're angry, but they don't get real angry. They tend to take their time. Yeah, he was openly rooting for the opposition Conservatives in the October 2007 provincial elections in Ontario. Made a couple of cracks about one particular fish, quote, went down just like the Liberals, blah, blah, blah. Mm. The Canadians got very upset. I don't remember Gaddis's attitude towards Ike, but I think he probably liked him, thereby demonstrating that I'm much too old to be working in the station right now.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and of course he joins me each week, apolitically, at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
And the sign said beer, bait, and ammo, yeah, they got everything in between. They got everything in the old beer drinking, hair-raising, bona fide, redneck knees.
At the ADT Championship in West Palm Beach, Florida, the LPGA's season-ending event, Annika Sörenstam missed the cut, thus concluding her pro golf career 2 days earlier than she had intended. Sörenstam had announced 6 months ago that after the 2008 season she would retire. She was elected to golf's Hall of Fame 5 years ago, and she has been victorious in 72 LPGA events, including 10 majors. Annika Sörenstam finished the season, and her extraordinary career ranked number 2 in the world.
If you ask me, they got it all. Signs and beer, bait and ammo. Yeah, if you ask me, they got it all.
Number 54 is the only senior on the basketball roster at Roan State Community College. Senior citizen, that is. 73-year-old Ken Mink took some time off between his freshman and sophomore terms, 52 years to be exact, and now he's hoping it's not too late to put a few more points on the board before he retires for good. In the process, he's inspiring granddads and grandkids everywhere to believe in the impossible. Only a Game's Kim Green headed to Harriman, Tennessee for the story.
Ken Mink's first basketball career at Lee's Junior College in Kentucky came to a rude halt in 1956. He was expelled for allegedly soaping up the coach's office, something Mink says he didn't do.
That's been like a hole in my heart for 52 years.
That wound didn't heal, even after 4 years in the Air Force, a 38-year career in journalism, and retirement in 1998. Then about a year ago, Mink was out shooting in the neighbor's driveway, hitting shot after shot, and suddenly it came to him. Maybe there was a way to finally fill that hole.
So I came in to the house where my wife Amelia was, and I said, "Honey, I've still got it." And she said, "You got what?"
And he said, "I believe I could play ball." And I said, "You got to be kidding." And he said, "You think I'm crazy?" I said, "Yeah." But that's okay. I knew that.
What she didn't know was that soon after, Mink started writing to colleges near Knoxville, where he lives, asking them if they'd consider letting him play on a team. For weeks, nothing. Then one day, he got a bite.
Where is our top man?
50-year-old Roane State Community College head coach Randy Nesbitt can be found at pretty much any hour, pushing his ball team with the energy of a much younger man. Between practices, he drills individual players on their skills and makes sure they're getting their homework done. He wants these kids to graduate and ideally get a scholarship to play at a four-year college. He says he was unprepared when Mink approached him about joining the team, but before long, Mink's qualities emerged.
He's a little bit awkward, a little bit stiff. He's a pretty good shooter. That looks really good. And I thought, well, you know, if he was perfect Jack LaLanne, it probably wouldn't be as interesting. You know, he's not cheated Father Time in any way. I mean, he runs like a 73-year-old, you know, but mentally he's just got that moxie about him that he believes he can achieve, even with the limitations he's got physically.
Not one of Mink's teammates resents the attention he's getting, or the 5 minutes of playing time you might see when the point spread's too big to worry about. In fact, they say, here's a guy willing to drive 70 miles a day, take a full load of classes, and work incredibly hard at practice with them through an old guy's aches and pains, just to mostly ride the bench. Bahamian Robson Memnon is a redshirt freshman at Roane State.
It motivates us, because to see him doing stuff that we'd be complaining about, and he doing it.
Forward Keith Bauer agrees.
If a 73-year-old man could show up, I could give a little bit of effort.
Cameroon native and forward Camille Ngonagon sees this phenomenon as one that transcends mere basketball.
This is a really, really great lesson that everybody have to learn on the team.
To believe in something that really seems impossible.
It's impossible. Yeah.
And it's good. Friendly roll.
Let's see if I can make 10 in a row out here, huh?
Ken Mink is hoping the impossible happens tonight. It's a shimmering Indian summer afternoon. The maples and oaks are fire with red and gold. Roane State's season opener begins in a few hours, and Mink's back in the neighbor's driveway where this whole saga began. He's shooting hoops with a young screenwriter named Andrew Chitko, who's come here with a future movie in mind.
Unbelievable!
The old man still got it, right?
I am a believer. Oh, my God!
Mink swishes 11 in a row from 20 feet out. Then he shows me a Kareem move only an old-timer would pull out.
Will you teach me the hook shot?
Yeah.
All right, show me this.
All right, Kim, here's what you do. Okay. Take a dribble with your right hand. Now, turn and hook. Yeah! Uh-huh. Look at it.
All right.
You scored over me. And wow. I'm 9 inches taller than you are.
He's going to need a few tricks like these tonight to have any chance at all against bigger, faster guys one quarter his age. Roane State comes into the second half up 46-16 against the King College JV team. Mink pedals a stationary bike on the sidelines to warm up. The gym is packed with about three times as many spectators as usual, including camera crews from Inside Edition and a local TV station. Roane State is playing its heart out, trying to rack up enough of a lead to get Mink onto the court. About 4 minutes into the period, Mink goes in. He gets one shot off and misses. A minute later, there's a tense moment when Mink gets trapped in traffic and breaks the pressure with a crisp pass. With a little more than 4 minutes left in the game, the crowd is eager for Mink to score. His teammates want it too, and they're trying their best to get him the ball. A Roane State forward drives the lane, draws Mink's defender, and hits him with a pass. Coach Nesbitt sees the whole thing like it's in slow motion.
With the greatest zeal I've ever seen a defender go after a shooter, he just dead sprinted. And Ken really has a lot of presence of mind. He shot faked him and started to go. But, I mean, there's no way Ken could avoid him. The guy was up in the air landing on top of him. And I guess in the defender's zeal to not be the one that allowed Ken to score, he was overzealous and put him on the free throw line.
Ken Mink's thinning white hair glows yellow under the gym lights. Roane State's home crowd goes quiet as, for the first time since 1956, Mink steps up to the free throw line in a college game. He sinks the first free throw, all net. No pressure. He's dreamed of this moment for 5 decades. Chalk up 2 for the old guy. After the buzzer sounds, he runs over to a roiling mass of male students with Raiders painted on their chests and starts giving high fives.
2 points tonight.
He's my hero!
Thanks for coming out here, guys.
You're welcome.
The shirtless guys surround him for a photo. The rest of the crowd presses in to congratulate him or just to soak in the feeling. One man puts his baby girl into Mink's arms.
Oh my gosh,
can we get a picture with you with her?
Oh, man,
please.
Sure.
Here, Kendall. Yeah. No, he's not going to hold you.
I'll just stand here.
As I watch this outpouring of emotion, I think about something Coach Nesbitt told me. He said that Ken Mink is not a sideshow, that people root for him because they want to see him accomplish something crazy, something he has no business trying to do. Because seeing the impossible happen, it lifts people up. Nesbitt and his ball team want to be a part of that. For Only a Game, I'm Kim Green in Harriman, Tennessee.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Carol Spendlove at CBC Ottawa and from Erica Bailey. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our Ken Mink photo gallery or Charlie Schroeder's Battle for the Golden Horseshoe pictorial, download our weekly podcasts or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from the home crowd at Ken Mink's first game as a member of the Roan State Community College basketball team. Ken Mink indeed. Sometimes I wonder why I quit competitive softball when I was only 50, but not often. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.